Accession number 28353, Reel 9.
These aeroplanes.
And what's the RAF fee? Peter, you've just described the responsibilities at your new post at as an Air Commodore at the Ministry of Defence.
Yes. I mean, what were we really responsible for? Well, on the macro side, I think we were obviously for operational posture, whether it be basing or function, for all of the forces for which I was responsible for. Supporting information to the air systems people or the operational requirements people for sustaining a particular fleet in being, or indeed looking for new aircraft or weapon systems coming into service. All of the aspects of clearances for aircraft and weapon systems, clearance to employ those once we were satisfied that they were safe, and so forth. We actually also handled the whole of the tasking for the Nimrod R force for its rather sensitive collection programs. All of that came through me to ministers who have to sign that off on a monthly or individual basis. The other thing that we got involved in as a major sign, I'll come back to that, of course, we were now at the time of changes post Gulf War I, and I'll come to that because actually Gulf War I occurred during my time in this particular post. But as Gulf War I was going on in sort of 1990, we were doing that exercise called Options for Change, which, if you like, was the Conservative government's first take on the peace dividend post the collapse of communism. And the extent to which, you know, the 38 or so percent reduction in the front line of the Royal Air Force, the closure of bases in Germany, the redeployment of various forces to take account of that. I was responsible within the Air Force Department, again, for writing all the papers supporting the restructuring of the front line of the Air Force post Options for Change, the details of which emerged just before Gulf War I in 91. As Director of Air Offensive, I was also the person who had responsibility for running the Royal Air Force Operations Room in MOD. We had an operations room on the fifth floor, which in conflict was fully manned on a 24-hour basis, covering all the different functions of the Air Force, briefing chiefs of staff, briefing ministers, providing advice, recommendations, and so forth. And I, one of my jobs was to run that ops room. I clearly couldn't do it on a 24-hour basis, so there was an equivalent Air Commodore from the defensive forces, D-Air Def as it was called, who used to dog and pony with me on that. But at the end of the day, I was the sort of the person responsible for the running of that room. So from my perspective, as being an officer with a really keen interest on the operational side of the Air Force, to me this was a great job at the one-star level, and couldn't have asked for a more interesting job. I was also responsible for the Air Force's interest in the F-117, the first of the stealth aeroplanes, because although we didn't have and weren't going to get any ourselves, we were involved in the program to the extent that we always had a pilot flying with the 117, even when it was a black program, because of the relationship between the United States Air Force and ourselves, and I was the line manager for this chap in America flying these aeroplanes.
And was the RAF the sole non-US
yes.
Air Force?
Yes,
it was.
Yes. Yes, and that's, you know, a mark of the relationship between our two services, that in this aeroplane and in others, that that's the sort of thing that the opportunities that we've always had. The exercise, not the exercise, the defence review by any other name, known as Options for Change, was, I think, not a well done exercise. Certainly some of it was fine, and I think in hindsight it's probably unreasonable to expect anybody in London to have foreseen precisely how the world would develop post the demise of communism, the outbreak of nationalism, the breakup of countries, the greater requirement for expeditionary type operations and so forth. I think it would have been very hard to have anticipated all of that. But nevertheless, I think the Options for Change thinking and deliberations were not well conducted. They were conducted by a very small team of military and civil servants, more civil servants, I think, than military. They were operating, if you like, directly to ministers. There was very little inclusion of the chiefs of staff and others in the deliberations, and I think a real determination by government to save money. No attempt to write a baseline paper looking at the foreign and security policy of the United Kingdom for the next 20 years, on which then to work out planning assumptions and things of that nature. And so, to a degree, sort of arbitrary decisions being made on the size and shape of the services for the future. And as I say, I think it's very difficult for them to have been alert and to anticipate all the changes that did subsequently occur, but equally I think a better result would have been found if the methodology of the Strategic Defence Review of 97-98 had been used, rather than this small cabal of people who locked themselves behind a door and came out with answers which pleased ministers but didn't really include any debate at chiefs of staff level or below.
And who were the members of this cabal?
Well, I can't remember them all now, because you almost didn't know who they were. But, I mean, for example, one of the people who was very heavily involved was the then Deputy Chief of Defence Staff for Programmes and Personnel, a job that I subsequently did. But a chap called General Boyd Carpenter was very heavily involved and was probably one of the more senior, if not the most senior, military officer involved in this procedure, not many military people at all. So it was very much a...
And he was able to operate without much say-so to in either to or from the chief of the general staff.
As far as I'm aware, that's the case. Yes, and therefore the size and shape of the armed forces were designed by this small team, endorsed by ministers, and then the services were told, now get on with it and decide how you're going to orchestrate it. So, for example, for the Royal Air Force, the Buccaneer was taken out of service, the Tornado squadrons were reduced in number, we started the pullout from Royal Air Force Germany. These were the sort of decisions that were taken by this team, and then we had to get on and implement them and decide then how best to base the resultant size of air force that we had. So we had to look to now redistribute the Tornado force, that we would move Tornadoes out of Honington, close Honington as a Tornado station, move them to Lock. So the detailed implementation was for the services to do, but they were given the template of what size and shape they were going to be by this small team who done it behind closed doors, got ministers to agree, and then said, that's what you're going to be.
Would you see this as a lapse on the part of the chiefs of staff at the time that they allowed this?
I'm not sure that they had any choice, and your own discussions with with Mike Graydon, although he wasn't the chief at the time, you know, would I think be more illuminating on that, because I think, you know, I was slightly below the level where I saw the chiefs of staff as much as he would know that they were being used. But I get that feeling because I worked for an assistant chief of air staff called John Thompson, who sadly died at the early age of about 53 or so. And if he had had real influence on it as the assistant chief, you know, I would have known about that, but I don't think we did. I think, you know, we were basically given the size and shape of the service. And it was, for the Royal Air Force, a really quite a substantial cut. I mean, it was about 38% of the front line, 35 to 38% of the front line went as a result of options for change. But it wasn't just the size of the front line, it was also the start, although not quite to the degree that it subsequently became, sort of 2 or 3 years later, but this drive towards privatisation, which started to come into the frame at that stage. In other words, whatever jobs it's not essential for uniformed people to do, then we should privatise them. Go out to industry, you can get a cheaper deal, because the capitation costs of a driver or a chef provided by external competition will not be nearly as great as if you train him yourself, because in your training you're going to teach him to be a guard and one or two other things as well as being a chef and so forth. And that became an increasing strand of pressure on all three services, and frankly was misguided in the light of what has happened since, because we now need cooks and drivers to be deployed overseas regularly. I think at that time those that did the options for change work thought that we were actually just going to operate inside this country, not deploy particularly much, and so we could rely on civilian chefs, civilian drivers and so forth. And those sort of decisions, I think, were misguided, and it goes back to not having a clear idea of how the armed forces were going to operate in the 21st century. That said, I can understand why they might not have got it entirely right, because I don't think anybody could have predicted necessarily what was going to happen at that stage. But I think the rush towards privatisation, contractorisation, was a dogma which the Conservative government beat the armed forces with as a means of reducing the requirement for defence funding. And we then went on, of course, subsequently from options for change to, there was then Prospect, and then there was there was another study done which was very much cutting the tail to support the teeth, and this is where contractorisation and privatisation came so much to the fore. I'll come back perhaps to elements of that, because as I say, I must have gone into the new job at the one star level in about August 1989, and a year later we ran into Gulf War One, and the manning of the ops room and so forth. There's no doubt that the Gulf War One was an air war, 100 days of an air campaign and 100 hours of a ground campaign, because the air campaign shaped the battle space to make a ground campaign almost unnecessary, but not entirely so, and therefore a very quick and relatively straightforward land campaign at the end of the day, much, I think, more straightforward and easy than many had predicted that it would be. Worries during the air campaign, there's no doubt that people became very concerned that we were losing aeroplanes at a rate per size of force greater than our American counterparts. We went through a best part of a week very early on where we lost an aeroplane every night. And that was starting to get to ministers without any doubt at all, and put the Air Force under considerable pressure. Why are you basing your operations on the low-level role? And why are you putting yourself at much greater risk than the Americans, who are doing all their air operations from medium level and therefore largely out of the SAM environment where you're putting yourselves in, not only SAM but AAA and small arms? Well, of course, that had been our total doctrine in for the Cold War, that we would go in low level. We had not invested money in defensive aids systems for defeating land-based radars which would control these surface-to-air defense systems, and so we had no option but to go in at low level. We had designed one of our primary weapons was this JP-233, which was probably in the world the most sophisticated weapon of all for taking out runways, for runway denial, but it had no medium level capability whatsoever. It had to be delivered from low level, and so we had no choice but to go that route, which meant, yes, we were probably more vulnerable than an aircraft operating at medium level, but we had never practiced medium level. We weren't equipped, frankly, with weapons that could operate that. We were equipped with weapons that were better than anybody else's if operated from low level. So we really didn't have a choice, but there was a great deal of soul searching going on, not least because we didn't appear to be as effective as we thought we would be with weapons such as JP-233. I think the answer to that is that we were actually attacking airfields which were huge in comparison to airfields that we'd ever thought of attacking. I mean, the Al-Takadum and the other airfields in Iraq were the size of Heathrow. And if you compared them with the size of our main operating bases in the United Kingdom, I mean, they're four or five times as big, which huge redundancy in terms of taxiways and things of that nature, all hardened with hardened aircraft shelters and so forth, but really very difficult to put out of operation. So though actually we did significant damage to the airfields because they had such redundancy in terms of concrete and taxiways, it meant that actually they were able to recover operations much quicker than we had anticipated the Soviets would ever managed to do so in a NATO war. So what appeared to be a somewhat lack of effectiveness and be a relatively considerably more vulnerability, ministers certainly started to get quite nervous, and the service had to do a lot of work to persuade ministers and others that A, what we were doing was worthwhile, and B, actually that, you know, that we had to do it the way that we were doing it. Once we had, if you like, stopped the Iraqi Air Force flying, and that was a combination of what we were doing and what the Americans were doing, then we actually were able to go up to medium level and start perfecting more of a medium level operation using laser guided weapons, doing some free fall bombing from medium level, but with new software packages in the armament system which would allow you to operate dropping free-fall weapons from 15,000, 20,000 feet, which wasn't something that we had done before. So, as I say, a lot of focus in the early days on trying to explain to ministers why we were losing aeroplanes at the rate that we were. And also, one of the jobs as head of the Air Force Operations Room was to get involved with one of the senior civil servants, who was our chairman, at something called the Press Non-Attributable Briefing Group, whereby most days we would meet in a grubby room on the ground floor of the MOD and conduct a non-attributable briefing to the defence correspondents of the daily newspapers in this country. And that was always an interesting procedure because I think...
Was that broadsheets only or everybody?
No, everybody. Everybody. Manchester Guardian, Daily Mirror, you name it, everybody. In their shabby Macintoshes, they would come in and and ask curly questions. But we had an extremely erudite civil servant who used to manage to get through most meetings without saying anything. Until he got caught out by Peter Snow one day. It is Peter Snow, the chap who used to do the swingometer?
Yes.
Who, when we'd lost six tornadoes, one a day, said, would this particular chap confirm how many aeroplanes we had lost in the last week? He said, because rumour has it, it's about six. And this chap, Mr. Bevan, tried very hard to avoid giving an answer to this question. And he said, well, he said, yes, he said, well, it's about six. Eventually, after about two or three iterations of this question, and Peter Snow jumped, well, he said, you know, he said, is it 5.9? He said, 6.1. 6.3, he said, or 5.8. And so eventually Bevan was forced to admit that it was six and not a fraction of an aeroplane. But they were actually, I quite enjoyed that, although my master at that stage was a chap, I say, this chap called John Thompson. And I really ought to sort of just say a word or two about this man, because he was a role model for me without any shadow of doubt. I knew of him sort of really from the first, not the first day I joined the Air Force, but as a youngster I knew that this chap Thompson existed. He was one of these people who was spotted at squadron leader level who was going to the top. There was him and a chap called Sandy Wilson, and they were direct contemporaries of each other. They had completely parallel careers all the way through the service in terms of flying and staff appointments, and they were seen as being great rivals, and one or other of them was going to get to the top, and there was going to be blood on the carpet and things of that nature.
And the other gentleman was?
The chap called Sandy Wilson.
Sandy Wilson.
I never really got to know Sandy Wilson. He was very much a Germany man, spent a lot of his flying time in Germany, whereas I did get to know John Thompson when I was on the Tacaval team that I spoke about. He was commanding one of the Jaguar squadrons at Coldershall, and I went for a briefing on the Jaguar to learn a bit more about the force, and he spent the whole day, took me to one side, gave me the whole day as a squadron commander, telling me what the Jaguar force was for, how they deploy and that sort of thing. And I came away from that, it was the first time I'd ever met him, and was immensely impressed. This was a chap, he seemed to have huge knowledge and things of that nature, and again quite a lot of charisma. And as a station commander at Cottesmore, he was my group commander. When I was doing this job as air offensive, he was the assistant chief of air staff, and from here on in until he died, at every stage, apart from one short period, I worked directly to him, although there was sometimes more than one rank between us. And so for about seven out of his last 8 years in the service, I worked directly for him. And to say, he was undoubtedly a role model. He had huge capacity. He was a really, really gentleman, a great sense of humour. Never expected anything of people that he wouldn't do himself. He was just a complete Air Force officer to me, and undoubtedly would have been. Well, he was nominated as Chief of Air Staff, and sadly died before he could take up the appointment. But the non-attributable press group was something that he would not do, and he said, "Squire," he said, "you're going to go and do that on my behalf." Mm-hmm. But he was a truly outstanding, and would have been the Chief of Defence Staff without a shadow of doubt. And it was a great shame for the Air Force, and indeed for Defence, that he died at the age of 53 before he could take up either of those appointments. I think one of the great pressures of this particular job, which sort of took therefore long hours, was, and I think this was something that people felt again very strongly about, although it did no good, was that here was the Air Force particularly, and to a degree the Navy and the Army, fighting quite a serious war over Kuwait, And yet at the same time, we were planning on how, the moment they came home, squadrons would disband. And we were having to say, rather like the Black Watch of the last month or two, when you, oh 50-umpty-ump squadron, come back from your current deployment, within 6 months you're going to be disbanded. And there's going to be a redundancy program and things of that nature. And I think that was very tough and very much resented in some ways by the Air Force, but also because we were actually, all of my staff were manning the Air Force ops room on a 24-hour basis, they were, for the period of the Gulf War I, working 16 to 18 hours a day, because they had to do their shift in the Air Force ops room, and then either before it or afterwards they had to go down and be writing these papers on how we were going to rebase the Tornado Force or rebase the Royal Air Force Regiment or whatever it happened to be. So it was a pretty tough and demanding time for those in MOD at that stage. This was, I suppose, the moment when I did my acceleration through the ranks, because, as I said earlier, I think anybody going to the top at some stage has got to accelerate quickly through one or two ranks if they're going to get to be sort of a three-star officer at 50 or shortly afterwards, which is what you need to do if you're going to sort of go on to be a four-star officer and command the service. And so I only did something like 9 months or so as an Air Commodore before being picked up for two-star rank. So Peter Harding was CAS at the time, and of course I'd known him from being CNC Strike Command, and he undoubtedly had taken something of a shine to me, I think, because say he had me up one day and said, right, it's time to move on, and you're going now to be SASO Strike Command, so the Senior Air Staff Officer at Strike Command, on promotion to Air Vice Marshal, which was quite a surprise, but not something that I worried too much about. The job at Strike Command was multi-hatted. It was, on the national side, the Senior Air Staff Officer, but it was dual-hatted with a NATO appointment, which was Director of Operations for UK Air, as a NATO hat, and therefore had both of those interests. I arrived at High Wycombe.
Can I just ask what age were you now?
This was February of 91. So that would make me 45, wouldn't it? Yeah. Not quite, 44. Just under 45. Yeah, 44.
As an Air Vice Marshal?
Yes.
That sounds quite young.
Yes.
Not.
Yes. No, I mean, again, I was probably the young. Well, I was the youngest Air Vice Marshal in the Air Force at that stage.
So that's twice you've done this, because you were the youngest wing commander.
Well, I must have been one of the youngest. I was very young as a squadron leader as well, but I then did quite a long time as a squadron leader, so I might not have been the youngest wing commander. I was certainly quite young as a group captain, and I was certainly the youngest two-star in the Air Force. Yeah. At the time, the Gulf was just winding down, and my job held with it not just the sort of the Senior Air Staff Officer, but the Director of Operations for National Operations. So we were still at High Wycombe at that stage, running the joint headquarters for the aftermath of Gulf War I. So we had all three services represented in the bunker at Strike, and I was sort of therefore running that on a day-to-day basis and reporting to the Commander-in-Chief, who at that stage, for a short while, was Paddy Hine, before he retired from the service, which meant that sort of, half my day was spent below ground in the bunker looking after the winding up of Operation whatever it was called now, Desert Storm, and half my time above ground, either looking at NATO issues or national issues, which would be the implementation of policy dictated by my successor in London, who was doing the DR off job that I had just vacated. I think of all the jobs that I have done in the service, this one required the most man-hours directly related to pure work than any other job that I've done. I probably made it more difficult than it needed to have been. I'm sure there are others who would not have found it necessary to devote so much of the 24 hours of every day to the job as I did, but I found trying to cope with the Director of Operations and the NATO and national day-to-day business required one to get up at 4 o'clock every morning and work through till breakfast, go to work, come home, not normally work after I got home, but that would probably be sort of 8 o'clock in the evening, go to bed at 11 or so and get up at 4, and that would really sort of, would certainly be 6 days a week, if not 7. And so for 2 years I did actually find that was quite a demanding routine.
That would be debilitating, surely.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. I am somebody who, providing I get into the routine of it, do not need a lot of sleep. If I get